Welcome to the Organic Guy Podcast. I am your host, The Organic Guy. This is, of course, your home of organic conversations. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Mr. Michelle Sculter, who is the director and co-founder of True Price as well as Impact Institute. Mr. Michelle, congratulations and thank you very much for joining me in the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, so help us really put things into perspective. So I'm trying to understand, like, take us back into your elementary school or in secondary school. Like, were you this kind of guy who was sort of interested in economics, or, you know, your friends just brings you a gift, for example, or a sweet, and you're sort of interested, how, you know, what is the economics behind the gift I'm getting, or this is something that sort of you learned later in life? So help us understand, where did the passion for the economic side, and especially, you know, when talking about True Price, really come from?
Primary school, I was actually it was more transformative education. So the Waldorfschule or the Rudolf Steiner Schule, which basically they taught us all sorts of activities, not just math and language, like how to cultivate your own garden according to kind of crop rotative principles, for example, or how to cultivate fertilizer from organic waste, but also, you know, making your own clothing, sewing, kind of working on iron, all sorts of things. So that was obviously, in a way, formative for me. But when I was a bit more conscious in high school, actually, I was we didn't really have money at home in my youth, and we worked hard to get some cash, also to also support a little bit my mother. I was a paper boy, and my mother always taught me to, you know, do world traveling and to help people who are in need.
Yeah.
And actually, I saved a lot of, well, at the end of the year, that it was particularly cold. It was extremely cold. And as a paper boy, you cannot really have gloves on your hands because obviously you don't have grip. So it was really, I almost cried when I was sitting on my bicycle every end of year. But in return, I was, I got some coins at the doors when I wished people with cards, wished them Happy Christmas, Happy New Year. Yeah. And when I told them I was going to make a world journey, I was traveling the world, I got like €5 or like five, it was guilders back then, five guilders coins, even bank notes instead of just coins. So people were really touched by my ambition to travel the world and help people who are in need. Well, actually, it was a little bit inspired by my mom when I was 18 and still at high school. Or 17, actually, or 16, 17, I got a book called End of Poverty by Jeffrey Sachs. It was an economist.
Yeah.
And that book really was a structured analysis of how communities can climb out of poverty through just, you know, it's kind of banal development interventions at a community level. And that is actually attainable. And I was so inspired. I thought, like, really, we can help people in poverty out of their situation, out of their suffering. Yeah. Let's go for it. So I mobilized in my high school a lot of my fellow students and also teachers. And we collected 6,500 euros in total to help people in poor. And I actually also, with some of the money I saved myself, I flew to Ghana, actually, to a small village in Swazi, between Kumasi and I think Mampong. It's another city in the central of Ghana. And then I saw how people were really having lots of trouble with sanitation. They were walking kilometers for getting water to drink, and there was a lot of diarrhea and obviously so many nutritional problems, leading even to starvation among children. It was so, for me, it was detrimental to see. It felt so sad.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get my head around. And well, I was luckily I had a lot, obviously a lot of money to do something with, you know, water pumps and stuff like that. But actually, when I went to study, I realized that these farmers and these farmer communities, they cultivated maize, they cultivated cocoa, but they did not really get a price sufficient to make a living. So they were kind of working the bottom, but staying into poverty. There was kind of no real perspective. And I felt it was a little bit sinister, actually. And I felt even that I was actually a bit ashamed. I did sociology at university, and I obviously was able to, you know, deconstruct systems and look at it from a critical perspective. And I felt like I was part of this neo-colonial, call it, well, it's kind of an excuse that we on the one hand have trade barriers that keep commodity producing countries poor. We have international arrangements and trade deals that keep many countries in the world in a role of dependence, making them very interchangeable, dependent on commodities. We do not let them grow industries. We do not let them make kind of relatively gross margins and net margins through kind of processing of the foods.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kind of play this sinister competition game. It's kind of a monopoly where kind of Europe and many European countries get the beef and those countries get the, you know, the small coins. And that's exemplary for cocoa, for coffee, for many of the kind of exotic or kind of tropical products from the angle of Europe. And I felt so betrayed because I did everything out of my idealism and to help people, and I was part of this sinister game of keeping people poor. And that was so, for me, it just I don't know, I felt like my the foundations it kind of eroded under me. I really was struck by it. I was privileged enough to join a think tank, which included many key decision makers, former prime ministers, former, you know, very high ranking business professionals as well. Yep. I was one of the few non-UN youth representatives that was part of that commission. And we were giving kind of recommendation in a think tank when I was a student to kind of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs about food security and stuff. But we had at that time a populist wind, and that meant that this opportunity to bring out those sustainability visions that was very narrow, and it actually vanished because there was the political power wasn't very interested in kind of saving the world. So we had to think of something to kind of well, still be sustained, drives the sustainability agenda. It was around the Rio Plus 20 conference in, I think it was 2011, 2012, but at the same time not be relying on political support. So we were in this working group. I can still remember sitting in the room, and this idea of a true price arose. The concept, the classical economic concept of externalities, obviously for, as a sociologist, you're oftentimes so puzzled so much, as if something is external instead of internal, instead of intrinsic, as if it's kind of collateral damage, which obviously is never collateral. It's always deliberate, especially if you are able to identify it as an externality. It's, you can call it, you know, a deliberate collateral damage from a transaction in a market. We were so, I was at least so struck by the fact that that was a household concept in economics. In economics books, it's taught to, you know, high school students that this is a, you know, a tragedy of the commons, but it's actually something that's there and it shouldn't be a tragedy. So, you know, if we have a true price and we can show the externalities, make it actually a unit that you can calculate and that you can work with, you can actually undertake action. You can actually address those externalities. So we said, why don't you add the external cost to the market prices, make it transparent, and with that information you can actually use markets, because they're still a meaningful transaction, and kind of, you know, entrepreneurs or the supply side, they can still use in kind of innovation, use their kind of resources, use creativity driven by technology to create products and services. The demand side can also pursue their interests through acquiring those products and services. So you have kind of a, call it exchange, a market. However, with this new information, you can actually integrate the social and environmental costs that are currently not paid for. So for me, that was like a, It really struck me like a comet. It really was for me the solution. Also because I had that shame, I felt like finally this can be the way. If we can pay those people, these billions of people, workers, and also hundreds of millions of smallholder farmer families, enough so that they can reach their at least their minimum living requirements, I felt like, wow, you know, this is the way forward. We can balance economics with decency, with human dignity. So that was how it all started. And well, that's 10 years ago or so when we wanted to bring this concept into the world.
Nice. I mean, yeah, that's an inspiring story from you, and especially, you know, when you explain it, like you went into the areas that you know, the raw materials come from, and you experience it first time, I think that's adds a little bit of juice into it, and you can say, you know what, this is what I witnessed, this was my experience, and yeah, this is what led me to do what I'm doing right now. And actually, that leads us into the next point. Maybe there's someone listening to this and this is their first time they're hearing about the idea of True Price. So yeah, so maybe they're wondering, wait, so you mean I have not been paying the True Price? I mean, the products I buy from the supermarket. So you can sort of help us explain what actually is True Price.
Yeah, so a True Price is the market price plus the social environmental cost in the whole value chain of a product.
Yeah.
Take, for example, when you use chemical fertilizer that is produced in a very intense and heated chemical process. Gas is used for that. That is super CO2, kind of, it emits a lot of CO2.
Yeah.
We account for that in the process of making any, call it agriculture product. We account for that chemical process and the CO2 emitted. That is very harmful for the environment. We say, what does it cost to absorb this, to kind of compensate for the emission? And, you know, you have to probably build or cultivate trees for that, or regenerate or the landscapes to absorb CO2. Any form of carbon sequestration is needed. That costs something. That's a price. And we add that price into the invoice administration. And then we do that for all the externalities, including the social ones. So for example, under earning, under payment of farmers and workers, that is a very important one as well. We just look at what is needed to get a decent living, what is currently paid or earned, what is the gap, and we add that gap. And if you do that, you end up with a higher price for all of the products, for sure. There's not a single product after decades of talking about sustainability, not a single product that's actually with a true price. So, you know, maybe a few cents more, maybe 25%, maybe doubling the price. You can do the same for health. So with lots of health, obesity, and all sorts of cardiovascular diseases from salt, sugar, and fat intake, all of those things, they add up to additional expenditures by the health administration, if or individuals that have to pay for that. We'd anticipate on that, add that. Well, if you have that information, you can improve. We have a store. I'm sitting here in a True Price store in Amsterdam. But we also have a network of stores. We have now the first True Price store in the world, an actual supermarket, organic by default. So everything there is organic, but it's still not enough, obviously. There's a lot of ecosystem services that are taken through the cultivation of that land. Water levels are lowered by the agriculture, which leads to a crop monoculture, which actually takes out the fish and destroys the aquaculture. That's another example of a frequently seen externality. So all of those things, we account for that, and then we actually calculate what it requires to restore, if you can compensate, if you can't restore, prevent, to make sure it doesn't happen in the future, and also to penalize, to kind of create a sort of fine, because we believe this shouldn't have happened in the first place. And it's actually, retribution is an important principle here, because many people suffer, and that is, in oftentimes it's actually in sharp contrast with the law. For example, child labor, forced labor. We have a situation where we have, in the current global production and consumption economy, you have, you know, between, let's say, 10 to 40 million modern slaves, which is kind of outrageous, right? Whether it's, cocoa production in West Africa, whether it's shrimp production in Southeast Asia, whether it's coconut production also in Southeast Asia, there's many cases, also even of child slaves. It's unheard of. And obviously many of those modern slaves are in informal markets, also in prostitution, but there's definitely a very significant number of those working in also in bonded labor, in fashion industries. But that's, you know, I just cannot comprehend, you know, that we can have this production consumption economy. We can create, we can fill the shelves with those products, literally with the fingerprints still on our cell phones of these, you know, exploited people. It's unheard of. It's unbelievable. And, you know, that's what we try to address. It's, it's really for me to save the world as well. Obviously on the environmental side.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much trouble that we see. And I'm not saying we should abolish production and consumption in the first place. I'm just saying that, you know, we have to really acknowledge the facts. Look, the beast in its mouth.
Yeah.
I would say call ourselves morally bankrupt. I think that is the least that we can do. We are, as a production and consumption economy, morally bankrupt globally.
Yeah.
Trade systems aren't, you know, actually, you know, they aren't ethically in sync with any, call it humane idea of what you could consider moral.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to build it up from there. We have to build it up from scratch. We need to take we can kind of get perspective and perhaps some hope out of that reconstruction of the economy.
Yeah.
But we have to call it a crisis, a complete total crisis.
Yeah. That's I think a very good point, well taken. And then, I mean, you've been around, you've been talking about True Price and also helping some companies adopt the True Price strategy as well. So I saw you had already worked with the likes of Tony Cioccolini, and try to give them a path on how they can also, you know, on their value chain, they can also implement the True Price perspective.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, you can share with us what you've seen from all this time. How has been their response, especially from a company perspective? What has been their response to the True Price strategy? Also from a consumer perspective, how have been consumers responding to this particular idea?
Yeah, it's really nice. I can, now we are also like filming through Teams. Like, I'm here in the True Price store, as you can see.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was the first place in the world. We actually deliberately moved our team. We are now with a bit more than 40 people.
Wow.
We moved our team from, let's say, the east of Amsterdam to this location. It's a very prime, call it retail location, in the where one of the most popular, it was actually called the most beautiful shopping street in the Netherlands. It was before Corona that we started here, 3 weeks before Corona. Tragically, we opened, and you know, Amsterdam obviously is a touristic place. Tens of millions of tourists coming here every year, came here every year before Corona. And you know what we noticed, and we actually have here at the, you know, you see here, you see the price list. So you see here the coffee, chocolate, and bread.
Yeah,
these are products that we then sold here. Here you see the, call it the product. Here you see the call it
price,
actual market price.
Yeah,
here you see the social cost, the environmental cost, the gap between, well, the actual True Price and all the other externalities. So there's still unpaid for externalities, and here you see the True Price.
Yeah,
and basically what we do, we charge that kind of market price. We also ask for a voluntary payment of the social and environmental cost that we can actually charge, so under payment, so poverty, but also carbon emissions, so kind of compensating carbon. People are asked that, and they can voluntarily pay for that. And you can see that on your receipt. When you enter and when you pay, you can actually get a receipt with those social and environmental costs. Really, of the hundreds of people who pass by, including tourists who, you know, they didn't come here for some sort of sustainability journey. They were just craving for chocolate because they had drugs and alcohol the night before.
Yeah.
That's why they entered the store. Not a single one of them. Not a single one of them wasn't willing to voluntarily pay for a True Price.
Yeah.
This was in sharp contrast with what marketeers were telling us and what they were afraid of. Product managers, category managers, retailers, they were also extremely skeptical. Professors. I can remember pitching competitions where I was bringing this story of the True Price, and professors were standing up and saying, we tried this 20 years ago and it didn't work. It's technologically not possible.
Yeah.
We had marketeers who said, this is communism. This is communist. You're dictating prices.
Yeah.
And we had entrepreneurs who were saying, you know, we shouldn't do it. Competition authority won't allow you to dictate prices. It's against the law.
Yeah.
And what you see in practice is that it is technically possible, and actually consumers love it.
Yeah.
Obviously, because you have a story. You know, we And I think that's kind of the tragedy of what you see in kind of retail, is that, you know, there's very strong intuitions about consumers, and especially in sustainability, organic, in that world, there's a lot of skepticism. No, consumers are not willing to pay. No, there's no use in communicating about it, you know, because they will only be skeptical. They will only feel that they are squeezed out. They were not willing to pay. And at the same time, these are the same marketeers that spent millions, billions on marketing to inform consumers to buy the most crazy, like, useless stuff ever. Have you seen Amazon? 80% of what you sell there is totally useless. Totally useless. Have you heard about drop shipping? That's this game of selling things for 300% of the price of what you find for that same product on Alibaba. And it's working.
Yeah.
It's working. And these are the same marketeers who are telling us that you cannot pay, you cannot ask a few cents more, you cannot double the price, you cannot communicate, no one will believe it. You know, it's all not true. It's rubbish. It's because they have cognitive dissonance. They feel such discomfort about the fact that their products are extremely ethically unresponsible.
Yeah.
They feel such discomfort that they just seek a reason why it's not working besides their own, call it, failing. Besides their own failing. They cannot accept that it was actually possible, but they failed that taking that opportunity to actually work it out. That's what I would consider the reason why this is not kind of brought to scale. And, you know, we've shown it. And also we've now introduced in the supermarket, the sales where we introduced it was basically what we do every Black Friday.
Yeah.
We organize a true price festival. Black Friday is the most banal event that I would say in the world, because what we do there is we put, it's called steroids. We push steroids in the market just to sell even more useless stuff.
Yeah.
That is extremely pollutive, extremely exploitative. But then we lower the price. We have, you know, billions of people gathering in stores, buying that, and we celebrate that it's so cheap. You know, that's kind of the most banal thing to do ever, given that we have huge scarcity, we have huge environmental problems, we have huge poverty and exploitation in these value chains.
Yeah.
So what we did is we said, okay, let's call it Black Friday, but instead of we make it a true price festival, we increase the prices with the margins that are needed to compensate for the social and environmental costs.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've launched the first supermarket in the world. The sales didn't kind of decrease. It didn't kind of, you know, stay constant. It actually increased again. The sales increased when the true prices were introduced for bread, for vegetables, and for fruits. And we're now kind of also looking to the many of the dry products like spaghetti and nuts and stuff to do the same. You know, so this is kind of what we're trying. And we're actually trying to scale this up further to dozens of retailers.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's kind of a scalable proposition. And we do it with a lot of data scientists, with a lot of software and kind of mathematical kind of professionals.
Yeah.
Mathematicians. So, that's basically what the True Price movement is about.
Yeah, interesting, because when you just mention it to someone, the idea of it, the first thing that comes to mind, oh, my price is going to go up. So I'm going to, you know, be wanted to pay more for the goods that I buy. And also from a retailer perspective, they're like, hey, I am not willing to increase the price because people won't come and buy products from me. So when you tell such a kind of the experience that you've had, actually, hey, look, we are already tried this concept and people are actually coming and buying. So it's very hard to argue against such a kind of testimony, I guess.
Well, to an extent, I mean, I can still argue against it, but from a completely different logic. It's more like you don't trust retailers, because retailers do, they, on the one hand, in a way, I mean, they're not unique. Everyone is exploiting, but they are exploiting too. They are suppressing kind of smallholders in many of the kind of global value chains, not deliberately, but it's the outcome. It's kind of the banality of evil that it happens. And at the same time, they dare to, you know, give huge dividends, hundreds of millions of dividends to their shareholders, to give like tens of millions of bonuses to their top executives, to pay themselves extremely well, to basically to bathe in money.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they then ask for a few cents more because it's insufficient to close the gap, it's not very, call it, convincing.
Yeah.
That, you know, they in a way bank themselves on the goodwill of the consumer. So, you know, there is obviously a problem.
Yeah.
But that's more a trustworthiness problem, and which is a kind of much bigger problem, I would say, because that is a huge, call it, there's a huge crisis when it comes to trust in corporations and also in regulators for that matter.
Yeah.
But, you know, it has nothing to do with the willingness, the intrinsic willingness of the consumers to step up when it comes to sustainability. You know, let me just give another example why it's not the case at all. You know, if you have two t-shirts, like polo t-shirts, you know, with these collars, one with a horse, you know, the horse polo, horse kind of branded Ralph Lauren or whatever, and the other one without, there's a €80 difference in willingness to pay, or maybe doubling. If you have a Nike logo, you have a doubling of the willingness to pay.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, 500% more that you want to pay for, because you associate that with something you want to stand for. It's an identity.
Yeah.
I would say for, you know, between 40% to 80% of the consumers, depending on where you are, that have the means.
Yeah.
They are obviously willing to pay for that positive identity that they get when they, you know, sign into this partnership to address challenges when it comes to environment or social or whatever kind of dimension.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that there is inequality, there's income inequality and wealth inequality. So obviously, let's say in the Netherlands alone, but in Europe even more so, but especially globally, there's lots and lots of people who are not really able to pay for those additional, call it, margins. Given that that is the case, you have to think also of kind of a policy adjustment. So what can we do to, in the one hand, address that the fact that, which is a very cruel fact, that many people are not actually even financially able to pay for sustainable and healthy food.
Yeah,
that's very, I think it's extremely cruel, right? That you have in the Netherlands millions, but in Europe, I would say 100 million, maybe, people who wouldn't be able to acquire healthy and sustainable food, because it is such a drop in their purchasing power that they, you know, cannot get the money for that, and it has lots of additional complications.
Yeah.
But that requires financial redistribution, just as simple as that. Meaning, you know, in Europe alone, we pay almost 50 billion a year to farmers through subsidies, largely on income support, direct income support, with really vague requirements, which is just, in my view, really inefficiently spent. If we just take a large proportion of that. But also, if we look at expenditures on healthcare, I think in the Netherlands, we have, you know, 1/3 of our expenditures on the government is spent on healthcare. It's like, I think it's like between 80 and 90 billion per year. If we take at least 1/3 of that, that is related to lifestyle or welfare diseases, you know, such as cardiovascular diseases, which really relate also to the food that you consume. If we just take those expenditures, and instead of having to pay that kind of in hindsight, you can actually better spend that in making sure that there's access to healthy and sustainable food.
Yeah.
So subsidize in a way these lower income groups to get access to better food.
Yeah.
And at the same time, obviously, you have to regulate much stricter the kind of production of all sorts of food and the supply side. People have this false idea that if you make things more sustainable through, for example, sugar tax or whatever kind of normalizing intervention that you have in the market, people think it's kind of suddenly an infringement of free markets. But what they fail to understand is that currently the market is extremely regulated already.
Yeah.
Kind of food safety, for example, it's extreme. There's nothing coincidental when it comes to packaging or positioning or what enters the supermarket. It's extremely regulated.
Yeah.
So there's no such thing as a free market in the first place. It's extremely regulated. However, it's poorly regulated. It's very, you know, perversely regulated. What it actually does, it's kind of rewarding exploitation, pollution, and kind of destruction of health. And it's, you know, disincentivizing the opposite. Obviously, organic is, it's much better than non-organic.
Yeah,
you know, we can look in that in particular if you would like. But you know, there's a lot of things wrong in Europe, but also globally when it comes to the food system.
Yeah, it's a very good concept, I think. Now, I think it's Peter Drucker who said that what actually gets measured gets done, and I think on the other hand also we see organizations and maybe individuals who say maybe we can't put a price on nature, for example. Mm-hmm. So first of all, do you think that True Price is trying to put a price on nature in the first place, and do you think it's also a good idea to actually put a price on nature?
Yeah, it's a very, very good point, and I really like it that you bring that up.
Yeah.
You know, let's kind of, we have to first of all demystify this whole idea of economics, of pricing, of also kind of using information to influence decisions. We have to demystify that. Right now, there's a very, call it, limited understanding of all the choices that are behind it, all the different methodological choices that you can make, and what the implications are on the outcomes that you pursue. And I do want to say that there's decades of environmental economics, which is a discipline within economics that looks into, okay, what if we indeed kind of value natural capital, you know, for example, a tree, and, you know, then suddenly it can get an importance, it can be a factor into the market, and then, you know, we can trade and we can exchange, and then there's this hypothesis that when you value it, when you put an importance to it, when you make it kind of interchangeable, which is kind of intrinsic to pricing, then you can actually it will matter what you measure will matter, and then you can make kind of protective, you can actually protect it. I think it's a huge flaw. I think that's the tragedy of decades of environmental economics, that they thought if as long as we have a coral reef that gets valued for its ecosystem services, we, for example, value a coral reef for 200 million, you know, we can actually make sure that it's on the balance sheet of whatever project, and then, you know, we won't exploit it. Well, absolutely not. Obviously, the financial assets are so much bigger. In fact, we can actually print money. So, yeah, you cannot print nature. You can print money. So, by default, the value of that reef is inflated by valuing it in the first place. It's extremely tragic because, you know, it suddenly becomes a commodity. It's interchangeable. Yeah. You can write it off, and Shell or whatever oil company can say, well, put a price tag on that reef. I'll put my oil drill platform there.
Yeah.
You know, I've paid for it, but my profits are so much more that you can just, you know, legitimize the destruction of nature. And that is what has been done for the past decades. It's the tragedy. It's kind of good intentions paving the way to hell.
Yeah.
That's why we have seen one of the things that we have seen on the one hand, a rise of conscience about nature and conservation. And at the same time, we've seen a further deterioration of nature. We've seen in, for example, the WWF, you may know, they estimated that 86% of the animals have been destroyed in the past 50 years. For example, and we have in the Netherlands, 90% of biodiversity is under severe pressure. We have, you know, I think it's like 70% of the kind of birds, a particular kind of birds have been, they're gone by whatever reason. When we were going in the past to campings in the Netherlands, like driving the roads, we had all these insects on our windshields. They're gone. We don't even have that. Obviously, it's tragic, but that was at least a sign that there was some insects. You know, we know that globally there's a huge destruction going on. There's a total collapse of ecosystems and biodiversity, let alone the climate. So, you know, despite all the conscience, despite all the efforts, that's because obviously we, for a large part, the message was, wow, we're doing quite well in the world. We grew massively on the financial assets, and you know, there was some loss of nature, but netto, when we net it, it's gone well.
Yeah.
That was for us a departure of the true price methodology. We said, wait a minute, this is a bit weird. We value, but tragically, we do not really take an action. So what we said, we have to take a rights-based approach. That is a fundamental breach with this old thinking. We say, no, you cannot say what is the value of a tree in relation to a parking lot.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, you know, the inhabitant takes some shade from that tree, which is, you know, worth 200 euros per month, very fine. But the parking lot will give you 300 euros per month. So let's chop the tree, put the parking lot there, and we make 100 euro profits. And that is an increase of value.
Yeah.
That's obviously outrageous. That's not the way you can value. What we say, no, the tree has an intrinsic right in a way to be. You know, the tree just has to be there. It's kind of critical to have nature, sacred. What is, if you infringe upon it, what is the action that you have to take to restore, compensate, prevent, or kind of penalize the infringement in the first place?
Yeah.
It's a total breach with that discipline of economics. It's not the financial economic valuation approach. It's a rights-based approach.
Yeah.
The implication of that is that you can do the same for, you know, human rights. And actually, what we basically do is we grant rights to nature. Yeah. We grant rights to ecosystems, to soil, water, air, to a certain quality of all of those, call it stocks of value.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just kind of retrospectively call it re-engineer the path to kind of protection.
Yeah.
And to respect to kind of sentient beings, whether it's animals, you know, trees, plants, and all of the things that we are currently destroying.
Yeah. That's I think that's a very valid point as well. And then just to, get a close, I think it's something you also talked about. The good thing I like about you, you can see some of the problems that we have in the current system, and you actually offer different solutions on how we can tackle these problems. And one of the ideas that I saw you picked up when we were, you know, being elected as the minister of the new economy, you talked about the need to transform from the financial economy to more of an impact economy. So you can sort of tell us what is the difference, and why do you think the impact economy is sort of the best path that we can take?
Yeah, thank you. That's a interesting kind of question. So, you know, tragically, the current kind of financial economic system really disciplines markets to maximize financial, call it money, financial value for shareholders, which are owners of property, owners of companies.
Yeah.
You know, that is what is currently considered normal. Right. When you take the accountancy standard, for example, which is one of the institutions that comprises the call it global financial economic system, the accountancy system, really what it does is it helps and it kind of forces us, because it's actually a requirement. It's legally an obligation to count for your financial, you know, what is on the balance, what do you have in a balance in a at a certain kind of moment, and what is the profit and loss over time.
Yeah.
You have to account for that, and that is what, you know, we have millions of professionals trained in that language. You have to disclose that in tables. Investment decisions are made by that. You have to calculate a business case, which is nothing else than, okay, to what extent do you kind of maximize the, or like optimize the financial revenue for a certain project.
Yeah.
You know, that is what disciplines us. And despite good intentions, despite international frameworks, whether it's SDGs or Paris Climate Agreements or circularity, this is still the dominant thing that disciplines us. And it actually is many times in contrast with these kind of very important frameworks that try to safeguard sacred things, dignity things, right things, wealth, well-being things.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then when you drill down, we have like we have, I think it's like 40,000 listed companies disciplining themselves on the basis of those logic on that logic. But also we have, I think it's like 300 million companies worldwide who discipline constantly. We have markets constantly disciplining on the financial value. The things that are neglected is natural capital, social capital, human capital, intellectual capital, produced capital, all sorts of other capitals, and also the value not just to shareholders, but also to employees, to workers or employees, to farmers, smallholder farmers, suppliers, society at large, nature. They are neglected. They are not literally not counting. So what we say is you have to include them as well in all your decisions in the market. You have to transform accounting. You have to transform trade regulations. You have to transform fiscal policies. You have to transform, you know, public law in which all of this is perpetuated. You have to transform monetary regulation. All these institutions need to change in order to balance markets with what the world can kind of absorb, or what the biosphere can absorb, what is kind of physically possible,
yeah,
and kind of creates a planet that is, well, literally, or, you know, much more kind of explicitly sustainable, that can sustain itself.
Yeah.
So that, and that, you know, an impact economy is an economy in which work, then education, innovation, technology leads to, you know, dignity, to well-being, and to welfare. But in that order. So dignity first, well-being second, and welfare third.
Yeah, that's very, very well driven home. Just to finish it up, I was sharing with my friend that I was about to have this conversation, and, you know, I was sharing with her the whole concept of true price. And one of her reaction was, I do like the idea, but I think it's too good to be true. So do you think it's actually too good to be true of an idea? And what is your final thoughts and your final message to people who think that, yeah, maybe this idea is too good to be true?
Well, first of all, I would be super skeptical about anything that markets propose or that is kind of market driven, since, you know, we've seen so many failed projects and with so much greenwashing. So I think it's fair to kind of be skeptical.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, well, let's see. It's kind of for me, it's one of the only shots we've had. I think having true prices are the necessary condition for sustainability. Otherwise, it's just, you know, the same false, call it pretension that we are currently pursuing with all these schemes without true price, whether it's circularity, whether it's, I mean, even organic. I mean, it's not there yet. Let's face it. You know, there's a lot of externality still, and, you know, we need to kind of take a more transformative approach, more regenerative approach. Yeah. Now, why do I think it's not too good to be true? Simply because it has markets in itself. You know, cleaning soil, cleaning air, cleaning water, restoring, paying people fair wages, living wage, living income, getting forced labor out of value chains. There are actors needed. There are organizations needed that can kind of get some revenue from those activities, which is integral to kind of what companies account for then, and they can charge that, consumers pay their part. So it does make sense. We have kind of cases that show that this can work. But, you know, it starts also with a fundamental understanding. What I said, we have to demystify prices. We have to understand markets much more fundamental, and we shouldn't kind of objectify it. And we really have to get ownership of the methodology. It needs to be open source. Yeah. It needs to be taught to children at basic, like primary education, secondary education, at universities.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we have a total shift in culture. And then I think, you know, that can actually be true. But, you know, I like it. Too good to be true prices.
Yeah, interesting. But the whole point is that we have to start somewhere. And I'm glad at least you are in the charge. You're in the lead of bringing something different, something that a lot of consumers can actually want to be part of. As you've proven, people are coming to the store. Companies want to be involved in such a kind of a project. So yeah, it looks very, very good moving forward. So
thank you, man.
Yeah, so for me, it's a great thank you for creating time to have this particular conversation. It was such a pleasure, and I'm sure a lot of people will find this conversation of great use. And I'm sure they've picked a lot of ideas that they probably didn't know before they listened to this particular podcast.